Hello, friends. Welcome to Out of This World Radio with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting live from the studios of KKNW on 1150 AM here in beautiful Bellevue, Washington, just outside Seattle in the United States. The purpose of this program is to raise consciousness and make this world a much better and happier place, and I know that with everyone's help, we can and will make this earth a much better place. I want to thank everyone so much for listening today and for making Out of This World Radio one of the most popular talk shows in the Seattle area and the fastest growing metaphysical and spiritual radio program in the world with over 200,000 listeners in over 80 countries. During the first hour today, from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, we'll be interviewing Jerry Pollack from the University of Washington. I consider him one of the world's most famous and wonderful water professors, water scientists. Then for the first 30 minutes of the second hour, from 3 to 3:30 p.m., I'll be having on Michiko Hayashi, the Moto Peace Project from Tokyo, Leon McNaughton of the Clean Water Foundation here in Seattle, and Martha Childress of the Natural Choice Network, to talk about how we're all working together to provide clean water filters for free to the Hopi Native Americans in Arizona. During the last 30 minutes of the second hour, from 3:30 to 4, I'll have a wonderful gentleman named Clifford Mahody of the Zuni Indian Tribe talk about star people, the hollow earth, and the changes which are happening now on the planet. He's a wonderful fellow, and I'm so happy he'll be coming on. Before we start, I'd like to thank everyone's support so much for this radio program, because Out of This World Radio is a nonprofit program supported entirely by donations. And for those who'd like to donate, please go to the donate button at the top of the upper right-hand corner of the program webpage at www.outofthisworld1150.com and just click on it. I really appreciate your help and support, because I know together we can and will make we'll create a much better and happier world. And with that, I'd like to thank, really like to thank Corey and Sol and Kirkland for their generous support, and also everyone around the world who helped me raise consciousness and make this planet a better place. I'd also like to thank the many sponsors of this show, and we're also looking for sponsors and advertisers. Any advertising on the program will have a worldwide audience for your goods and services in over 80 countries. With that, I'd like to thank my dear friend Carol, who's been designing my website, providing wonderful support. My friends in the Galactic Alliance, who I know are listening today, have been supporting my show. My angelic and earthly family, and KKNW, without whose help and support this program would not be possible, especially Eric. I have a spiritual mentoring program where I teach people how to contact their angels and spirit guides. If you'd like to get in touch with your loved ones who've passed on or contact your guides and get some good spiritual advice, please send me an email to outofthisworld1150@gmail.com. And you can also call me here in the United States at 509-750-9793 or toll-free in the United States and Canada at 1-888-879-8339. My next Galactic Wisdom Conference will be held in Olympia, Washington. It'll be my fifth conference next year, from April 12th to the 16th, 2019. We'll have some amazing people, including Aaron Elizabeth of Health Nut News, as well as Simon Parks, who will be giving presentations. If you register before December 31st, the cost for the three-day conference will be just $55. After that, the price will go up to $125. If you're interested, please send me an email or just give me a call. In addition, next week, from September 6th to the 12th, I'll be taking a group of people to Mount Shasta Telos in the Hollow Earth. I've been sponsoring trips to Mount Shasta in the Hollow Earth for the past 2 years, and it's a wonderful opportunity to visit Telos in the Hollow Earth. At Shasta, we always see lots of Sasquatch and UFOs flying around the mountain. It's an incredible, amazingly beautiful place, and I hope you can come. There are still a few places left, and if you're interested, please send me an email to outofthisworld1150@gmail.com, or you can call me on my cell at 509-750-9793. One amazing thing that happened when we were at Mount Shasta in July, a couple of months, or just last month, is that the Sasquatch materialized in front of us from the fifth dimension into our third dimension. They looked at us, we smiled, we waved. They nodded their heads, and then they left. They dematerialized. While they were there, they created a beautiful peace mandala made up of branches of trees and pink rose quartz rock crystals. They told me telepathically that the crystals actually came from the Hollow Earth. The cost for the camping for the trip is only $200. And if you'd like to register, please send me an email. I also wanted to tell you briefly that I have some wonderful psychic and spiritual fairs coming up. Tomorrow and on Sunday, I'll be at the Crystal Spirit Center at 38th and Cedar in Tacoma, giving readings all day, and I hope you can come. Then on September 29th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., I'll be having Out of This World Galactic Wisdom Psychic Fair in Olympia at 9101 Stillicum Road in Olympia. The event is free, and I hope you can come. I also will have other events on November 10th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the same location in Olympia where Michiko Hayashi will be demonstrating her Hado vibrational machines. And she'll also be giving a presentation there as well on the messages from water from Dr. Emoto. Then on March 9th, 2019, I'll also be having another Galactic Wisdom Psychic Fair in Olympia at the same location. All of the events are free, and if you'd like to have a table as an exhibitor, the cost is only $50. What I'd like to do now is to play this tribute to Tom Lehrer. Actually, I've been in touch with Tom Lehrer recently. He just turned 90 years old in April a few months ago. And in my opinion, he was one of the greatest musical comedians of the last century. But we had a tremendous amount of smoke here for the last couple of weeks, which reminded me of his song named Pollution from a 1965 performance in San Francisco. And Eric, if you could please play this song briefly now, and we'll go on to my first guest.
If you visit American City, you will find it very pretty. Just two things of which you must beware. Don't drink the water and don't breathe the air. Pollution, pollution, we got smog and sewage and mud. Turn on your tap and get hot and cold running crud. The halibuts and the sturgeons being wiped out by detergents. Fish gotta swim and birds gotta fly, but they don't last long if they try. Pollution, pollution, you can use the latest toothpaste and then rinse your mouth with industrial waste. Just go out for a breath of air, and you'll be ready for Medicare. The city streets are really quite a thrill. If the hoods don't get you, the monoxide will. Pollution, pollution, wear a gas mask and a veil. Then you can breathe, long as you don't inhale. Lots of things there that you can drink, but stay away from the kitchen sink. Throw out your breakfast garbage, and I've got a hunch that the folks downstream will drink it for lunch. So go to the city, see the crazy people there, like lambs to the slaughter. They're drinking the water and breathing the air.
That's an amazing song. Every time I listen to it, it always brings a smile to my face. I have been in contact with Tom Lehrer. He lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts right now. And he said, next to money, he likes adulation the best. But he said that he doesn't do radio shows anymore. But I did invite him to call in. So, Eric, if we do get a call from Cambridge, Massachusetts, be sure to let me know. He knows our number. But, Tom, you're a great performer, and so glad you produced those songs. Anyway, now we have a serious guest now, Professor Jerry Pollack of the University of Washington. He's famous for discovering the fourth phase of water, and I think he's one of the world's most wonderful and famous water scientists. Jerry, how are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine, Ted, and thank you for having me. Much appreciated.
Hope you
enjoyed seeing those mermaids this weekend or last weekend.
I
heard about that.
Well, actually, what happened is I decided to take some rest and relaxation, and I go out to Tokeland, Washington. There's an Indian reservation there, the Shearwater Bay Reservation, and I have friends out there, and there's a beach that I go to, and I always see the heads of the mermaids and mermen bobbing in the water, and yesterday was no different. I went out there, and I waved at them, and they bobbed up and down in the tides, and they waved at me. And maybe one of these days, if they don't mind, I could invite them up the show. Haven't figured out exactly. They're going to have to keep wet, of course, once they get out of the water. But maybe a small tank.
Well, you could bring the show to the water. How about that? Would that work on a raft, maybe?
Probably. Yeah, get a waterproof iPhone and just kind of float out and just do a. Yeah, we could probably I'll do a pre-record out there. That's a good idea. Thank you, Jerry, for that.
maybe we could hear something from the mermaids about their concept of water.
Oh, that would be fascinating. Actually, mermaids and mermen, from what I've been told, Jerry, were actually created by the Atlanteans. They're half human and half dolphins, and they were created to go out and harvest shellfish and seafood for the Atlanteans. And
oh.
then when, of course, the Atlantis civilization imploded upon itself, the Atlanteans went bye-bye, but they still had their species and their civilization underneath the ocean, so to speak. And they've been there ever since. I've been told that there's a pod of them, actually, off of Whidbey Island. There's another pod off of Westport and Tokeland, Washington. And there's different pods in the ocean, depending upon the geography. But those are the two pods I know about here in the Northwest.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Do they toy with the whales?
I think they probably do, actually, because they're half dolphin, and they probably communicate with the dolphins. Dolphins themselves, I've heard that, Jerry, you might know more about this, are actually have the brain of a 5-year-old. It's like almost childlike, but they're very intelligent. They have a huge brain. And
well, I have heard that. Yeah. Indeed. This would be really interesting to invite them one day, and would be interesting to even I will listen to your show if you have some mermaids present. Would be great.
Okay. All right. Well, next time I'll probably need to spend a bit longer than just a couple days out there. I'll try it. Yeah, I will try it. I know that they're there, and I do see them. I've been told that as the vibration of the planet keeps rising, as Dr. Emoto used to say, everything's hot over vibration, they're showing themselves more and more, and they're less and less afraid. They always, in the past, they've always tried to hide themselves, Jerry, because they don't want to get shot, and they don't want to get killed or eaten, God forbid. So they've kept themselves kind of hidden, much like the Sasquatch. The Sasquatch down at Mount Shasta, I'm going to Mount Shasta. I'll be in Mount Shasta a week from today, broadcasting live from there. We always see them. And the amazing thing is that the last time I was there, Jerry, in early July at Mount Shasta, there were Sasquatch which materialized into our third dimension. And then Michiko saw it. It materialized not far from her. He looked at her, and she looked at him, waved, and then he nodded his head and materialized back to whatever dimension he came from, probably the fourth or fifth dimension.
Wow, you live an interesting life. So far beyond us mere scientists who live mundane lives in the laboratory, playing with our Petri dishes and microscopes, your life seems far more exciting than ours.
Well, if you like, I could maybe bring one down for you. I don't know. I'd have to ask them. One thing they do like are white frosted cinnamon rolls, preferably organic. And they can't get them out in the woods. Maybe I could work out a deal with them when I'm at Shasta next week, saying, hey, for 10 cinnamon rolls, will you come along with me? We'll have extra room in my car. I've got a big car now. And they could come down along with us. One thing I have to, this is a true story, Jerry, at our last trip there in July, the Sasquatch built what they call a peace mandala made up of twigs in a circle. And in the middle of the circle were a whole bunch of rose quartz rock crystals. And they say that were from Telos and the Hollow Earth. And they did it for world peace. I've got a couple of those. I left most of them there. I took just a couple of the crystals from their home, but I think they're still there, and they did that as a peace offering. So they're very benevolent. Back in September of 2016, I was at Mount Shasta. This is another true story, where one of the people on my trip came there late one night. She'd driven in from Minnesota in a van, and she'd been crippled for about the last 30, 40 years, and she couldn't walk around, Jerry, without crutches or a cane or wheelchair. And so anyway, it's about 2:00 in the morning, and suddenly she wakes up and she's contacted by the Sasquatch, who she said had surrounded her van. And they asked her telepathically if she'd like a healing for her legs. And she said, oh, yes, I would love a healing. So the next thing she knows, there's an extraterrestrial craft from the Hollow Earth hovering above her van, and a beam of light hits the top of her van. The van opens up at the top. She's beamed aboard their craft like on Star Trek. They give her new legs. They fix her legs. And then they put her back in the van. That all happened between 2 or 3 in the morning, and she falls asleep. And the next morning, she's running around our campsite, screaming, yelling at the top of her lungs, "They healed me," over and over again. And so somebody, I calmed her down, and I said, "Who healed you? What happened?" And she explained the story, what happened. And she'll be coming back again on this trip I'm taking next week. So she'll be driving in again from Minnesota. She wants to thank the Sasquatch for healing her. As far as I know, she's still able to walk just fine and no problems.
My goodness. As I said, you live a really interesting, exciting life, I must say.
Well, thank you, Jerry. And you do, too. Your work's incredible. And one of the things, of course, you know what I could do? I've got your biography here, and for the next 40 minutes, I could just read off that. Or we could continue with your interview. I think my listeners would probably want me to continue with your interview. It would.
Sure, I'm happy to talk about anything you like, anything about which I know something. I certainly don't know about the topics that you've been talking about, but I must say they're intriguing.
Well,
sure.
One of the things I want to follow up on, I want to do some meditation between now and the Water Conference in October. Is to get some more information on an organic computer using water with a it's like the fourth phase of water. It's like H2O2. It's like
H3O2.
Oh,
right.
H3O2. Yeah, extra hydrogen. And so that could be used as a storage device for an organic computer. Now, the interesting thing is when I'm down at Shasta next week, we always see the Talosians down there. I'm going to ask the Talosians, I'm going to ask him. I hope I can understand this, or I'll ask him to send it up to you if you want. What are the scientific formulas, the chemical compositions for their organic computers? That's what they say they use, which is thousands of years ahead of us. And they say that their organic computers, which are water based, have a far greater memory storage than our metallic metal computers. I don't know how they work, but they said that's how they use their that's how they store their data is
well,
water.
Yeah, if so, I think they really are onto something. Yeah, I mean, what we found, as you know pretty well, is this fourth phase of water is actually a crystal. It's ordinarily a liquid crystal, but an Italian group of scientists, Vittorio Elia and colleagues, found that they could actually produce from this easy water or fourth phase water, we call it either one. They can produce out of this. They can produce solid water at room temperature. So sort of like you might say ice at room temperature, mm-hmm. out of this easy so this material is a crystal. Usually it's a liquid crystal, but it can be easily made into a solid crystal. And it's not so different from the silicon crystals that are used in computer memory. So if you think about it, computer memory is basically a three-dimensional array of precisely positioned atoms of silicon or silicon dioxide and such. And each one of them could be undergo some change which people would interpret as on-off or 0-1 or such. And if you have a whole array of this, you have the capacity for a huge amount of storage of information. It just depends on the distribution of zeros and ones in that array. So in terms of the easy water, you have something similar, but actually potentially even better, even hugely more storage capacity. And the reason is that, as I said, easy water is a fourth phase water is a crystal, and the crystal consists of oxygen atoms, and the oxygens are distributed also in a very regular, it's actually hexagonal, three-dimensional array. And so you'd imagine that if each of these oxygens could have two states, like a 0 and a 1, you'd have something very similar to a standard computer memory, but actually it's much better than that, because those of your listeners who may be versed in chemistry a little bit, oxygen has actually five, not two, different different oxidation states. And so it could be -2. That's the one that we usually know about and are familiar with. But it also can be -1 or 0 or +1 or +2 even. So that means that each oxygen in this three-dimensional array has not two states, but 5 different oxidation states. So in theory, you have far more capacity for information. I don't have it at my fingertips, but we calculated once the advantage of this kind of array over a standard computer array, and it's something like 1 billion times. In other words, you could pack, in theory, this is in theory, you could pack 1 billion times the information into one of these EZ crystals, or H3O2, as you mentioned, or fourth phase crystals, as you can in a standard memory. And also, since you can actually produce it as a solid at room temperature, there's a capacity at sometime in the future that it's possible that your computer memory may consist of EZ water in a solid state. And the information density is amazing. But when you think about it, so we're talking now about a useful technological device, but another useful technological device sits inside your body. You know, since your body is filled with this fourth phase or EZ water, then it has the capacity for information storage. Now, so, you know, most people are not familiar with the concept of information storage in water, and particularly information storage in your body. But there's a huge literature that just keeps building each year. Each month, practically, about evidence for information storage in water. For example, in the body, and presumably that's in the water because that's where that's the major component of your body. Most people don't know it. We all think that we're 2/3 water, and we are by volume. But you know, if you pull out all the molecules in your body and just line them up and start counting, more than 99 out of 100 are water molecules, because the water molecule is so small that in order to make up at 2/3 volume, you need to stuff a lot of water molecules in there. So we have a huge number of water molecules, and if there is information storage in the body, there's a good chance that water may somehow be involved. And so there are experiments. I'll just mention one that was reported last year at our annual water conference. Mm-hmm. I guess you know it, but I'm not sure if your listeners do. The water conference is annual. It takes place in Bulgaria, and it's coming up this October. I can't remember the dates exactly, but it's middle
18,
of October.
19, 20, and 21.
Thank you very much. I'd have to pull up my calendar, but each year it varies, and so I have trouble remembering.
Sure.
And at this conference, there are many, many reports that have to do with water memory, and I just remember one of them from last year, where one of the researchers, his name is actually Kernbach, and he was reporting he has a container of water that sits in his laboratory, and he has a very elaborate way of measuring the physical properties of this water. It's called impedance spectroscopy. It is kind of fancy lingo for basically measuring what you might call the resistance of the water at different frequencies. And a plot, he can generate a plot, and the plot looks like some kind of squiggle with ups and downs, and it's pretty much consistent. However, he asks someone from as far as 10,000 kilometers from his laboratory. He didn't say, but I suspect it was New Zealand or someplace like that. His lab is in Germany. And he asked the person at a particular set time to focus his intention on the water over this long distance. And he showed the result. You know, they had a predetermined time when this would happen. And he showed a plot of what happened immediately after this person focused their intention on the water. And the graph that he showed, taken from the impedance spectrograph, was wildly different from the original one. And so it's clear that some information is getting transferred to his laboratory from as far as 10,000 kilometers away, which is truly amazing. So this is the kind of result that is representative of some of the work that is presented at the conference that demonstrates that there's information storage in water. And since your body is made up mostly of water, there's a great possibility that information is stored in the water inside your body. A lot of people think so. This is not conventional science, but the evidence is pointing in that direction. So I think it's pretty cool. And any of your listeners interested in that conference, it's just waterconf.org. Very simple to find.
Wonderful.
And it's an exciting meeting. So this year, as we often do, we have Nobel laureate Luc Montagnier, who's going to give the opening talk. His stuff is pretty controversial, but so interesting. The classic experiment that he reported 4 or 5 years ago, and he's built on from there, is you take I'll just repeat it because it's so earth-shaking.
Mm-hmm.
He takes a container that contains a short strand of DNA. It's actually DNA in water, highly diluted.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a closed container. Nothing comes in, nothing comes out. And he puts it next to a container of water, just pure water. The two are sitting next to each other. There's no possibility of any chemical transmission. But he says that the information that's coming out of the highly diluted DNA, actually, he says he thinks it's coming from the water that surrounds the DNA rather than from the DNA itself.
Mm-hmm.
So that water is coming out of the tube, and it's sitting next to a tube of water. He says that the tube of water is absorbing that information and getting the information. So then what he does is he's using this tube of water to create new DNA. And the standard way of doing it is the so-called PCR technique, which is an amplifier of DNA. Anyway, it contains all the raw materials for making DNA, but the critical feature of DNA, of course, is the sequence. Mm-hmm. And so when he puts this special water in these chemicals, he gets new DNA, and the new DNA has the same sequence as the DNA that the water was sitting next to. So if true, this is really amazing. And it seems to have been confirmed by several independent groups. So this is very exciting because it shows that information can be transmitted from water to water. And he's taken this further because, since we have so much water in our bodies, the idea of exchanging information from externally to our bodies to influence, heal, can be a really powerful technique in the future for medicine. So you triggered me with your comment about memory and organic substances.
Mm-hmm.
And triggered me to think about water and how critical water is and how possible it is that water can be technologically extremely useful in the future, even beyond the stuff that we drink and the stuff that fills our bodies. So very exciting times.
Oh, that's just amazing. It's just fascinating what you're talking about, Jerry. And that leads me to my next question. What's new at your Institute for Venture Science?
Oh, well, thanks for asking. Let me say what is the Institute for Venture Science. Short sleep last night, I guess.
That's all right.
the verbiage is affected. But
sure.
But anyway, the Institute, so a little background. This is an institute that funds promising ideas that challenge the status quo, that challenge conventional wisdom in science. You know, there's a lot of conventional wisdom around, and science usually moves, though, by revolutions. The real scientific advances occur somewhat by the incremental advances that occur on an everyday basis, but the things really change when someone comes up with a revolutionary idea that turns science and turns the world thinking upside down. Examples? Well, we were talking about DNA, the genetic sequence that determines heredity. So that was, I think, 1953 or 54. Was that
53 years,
than 60 years ago, anyway.
Crick
so
and
that
Watson.
changed a lot, and that was clearly a genuine scientific revolution. And then another revolution, maybe 10 years before that, was the splitting of the atom. You can argue whether that was had positive or negative impacts, but it certainly had impact for everyone.
Sure.
And early in the century, all kinds of scientific revolutions in physics, like relativity and quantum mechanics, and so many of these appearing practically revolutions practically by the year. And now, if I were to ask you, Ted, or your listeners, can you name in the past 20 or 30 years a scientific revolution of comparable magnitude to the ones I mentioned that have succeeded, not promised to succeed, have succeeded in changing the world? And I'm not talking about technological advances, the first response when that question is asked, oh, yeah, the iPhone or the Internet or something, but those are technological. I'm talking about fundamental science. And so there haven't been, when I ask the question, usually I get a blank stare.
Right.
And from scientists and non-scientists, it's really hard. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really hard to identify a fundamental scientific revolution that has changed the world. One or two people say, well, the Higgs boson. So if you remember, that particle was predicted and discovered a few years ago, and Nobel Prize was given. But I don't know too many people whose lives have been impacted by the confirmation or discovery of a Higgs boson.
Right.
Sounds like a new popular dance or something like that. So the question that you might ask, or anybody might ask, is, well, gee, you know, the amount of money that goes into science, the funding for science through all of the agencies and other sources, has grown enormously in the past, well, say 100 years. But if we go 100 years back, when there was very little money for science, the number of revolutions, fundamental scientific revolutions, was huge. And now that the amount of money that goes into science has become huge. Of course, scientists are complaining because there's never enough money to do the experiments they want to do. But the funny thing is, or the paradox is, that despite all this money, the revolutions are, you know, few and far between. And so this is a paradox. It's actually not a paradox, because we think we understand the reasons why this is happening. And the reasons, I'm getting to the question about IVS that you that you asked, Institute for Venture Science. I'm giving the background rationale. So, so we don't have, we have a lot of money going in, but we have very few scientific revolutions. And I think the reason for this is has to do with the system of doing science today compared to 100 years ago. So 100 years ago, scientists were people of great passion. They went into science because they really had curiosity to find out what was going on, and life was not so easy because they didn't have a lot of money. But often either they came from a family of wealth, or some benefactor was interested in supporting them. But it's different today. Science is kind of like a profession, like law or medicine or science. And for a lot of people, if you did well in chemistry or biology in university, then you say to yourself, well, you know, maybe I'll go into science. So not always, sometimes is, but not always that kind of passion that existed 100 years ago. So people go into science, and then in order to survive in science, you need money, because most science is done at institutes or universities. And in order to run a scientific show, you need to hire people. and hiring people costs money, and you need to buy supplies, and you need to buy equipment, and that costs money too. So item number one on the menu, get money. And so how do you get money? Well, you apply to one of the scientific funding organizations, like the National Science Foundation, or if you're interested in health, it would be the National Institutes of Health. And so the example of the difficulties that revolutionaries encounter, the one I like the best is the shape of the Earth. So suppose you're in an environment where everybody around you knows that the Earth is flat. If you just look outside, you can see that it's flat, and mm-hmm. you know it's a no-brainer that the Earth is flat. And suppose in this environment where everybody thinks it's flat, you come upon some evidence that makes you think, hey, well, maybe it's not flat after all. Maybe it's a sphere, and the evidence that you have is first you've seen some satellite photos, and it looks like it's not flat. It looks like, you know, it might be a sphere. And the second is that you take off from, say, Seattle, and you go west, and you land in Hong Kong, and then you keep going west, and you land in New Delhi, and then London, New York, and back to Seattle again. And you look out the window because you want to see the edge, the corner, the edge of the flat Earth.
Right.
And you look and don't find it, you see, and you get back to where you were. And so if you can get back to where you are, it is kind of implying also similar to what you've presumed from the satellite photos that mm-hmm. looks like a sphere. So you take this so-called preliminary evidence, and you're thinking, this is really an important topic. I want to get some more money to study it, because if the Earth mm-hmm. is round instead of flat, that has huge implications for everything we understand about science.
Sure.
You go to the National Science Foundation, and you write an application, and you say, hey, everybody thinks the Earth is flat, but look at this evidence. It looks like it might actually be a sphere.
Mm-hmm.
And please, can you give me some more money so I can staff my laboratory, so I can go and study it some more and find out the real shape of the Earth, which we think might actually be round instead of flat. And so this application goes to a gatekeeper. Gatekeeper looks at Ted Marr's application for a round Earth, and says, "Oh, this looks pretty important. I better make sure to get the world's experts on the shape of the Earth to evaluate this application to see if it's good enough to rise to float up to the top of the pile of applications. We can't fund them all. We can just fund 10-20% of them, and see what it looks like." So the gatekeeper then goes and hires the world's experts in the shape of the Earth. So who are the experts? Well, they're the flat Earth people. They're the mm-hmm. leaders of the flat Earth concept, or the flat Earth paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that they would like to be displaced by Ted Marr?
No.
If Ted Marr is right about his round Earth, then their prestige will be diminished hugely, because they're the experts in the flatness of the Earth. And so this is just an example of so many. Any scientist who dares to challenge the persisting or existing paradigm has a hard time, because you simply can't get the money, because the people who decide whether you get the money or don't get the money don't want you to succeed. They would prefer to remain. It's just human nature. You
sure.
know, we if we feel comfortable in our position, we don't want anybody to jar us, to spoil the situation that we now enjoy. And I think this is the reason why there are very few scientific revolutions, because scientists have learned that if they put forth a revolutionary idea that steps on the toes of the experts, they're going to lose. And it happens almost every time. At one time, I thought I might be the exception to the rule, but I've had my ups and downs, as well as almost every scientist I know from the time of Galileo, probably before, until today. All kinds of scientists of the current era simply cannot get a fair hearing on their idea.
Wow.
And so 10 years ago, approximately, had the idea, I want to do something about this. And this idea has actually grown quite nicely into an institute, and it's called, well, the Institute for Venture Science. And what the institute does is it solicits applications, starts with pre-proposal before the proposal, from anybody who has a revolutionary idea. And the idea has to be an idea that, if correct, if validated, would shake the earth. And the ones that have the potential to shake the earth more maximally are the ones that interest us the most. And so we got more than 200 of those, and they were carefully vetted by open-minded scientists who are not directly involved in the field, just far enough from the field that they can understand the content, but they're not threatened because they don't care if the earth is round or the earth is flat. It's not part of their being. And we picked 15 out of that, of those, and 12 of those submitted full proposals. And those full proposals are in the process of being vetted. We've already picked out three of them that we like and that we're going to put forward. Several of them are still being evaluated, and a few of them were turned down. And we're really excited about these because there's the potential that these, if funded, and we're looking for funds now. We have some funds, but not a whole lot.
Jerry, yeah. How can people contribute? I know I just got an email. Where can we send the check to? Or do you say PayPal?
If you look on the Institute website, it's very simple to remember. It's IV for Institute for Venture, ivscience.org. IVscience, no periods, no dots, okay. ivscience.org.
Okay.
And there's a way to do it. If it's a modest donation, it goes right through. If it's something more, then they can connect with me, and we can discuss and such. And we're looking for donations.
I couldn't think of a better cause for people out there who would like to support a wonderful program that Professor Pollack has. Please consider his ivscience.org organization.
Yeah, thank you for that plug. I just before we leave the topic up. Just want to say that there's one feature that's unique in our program, and that is, you know, if you go back to the round Earth, flat Earth idea, even if you have your round Earth proposal, even if you get funded by some agency, Ted, and you start making observations, doing experiments, and you have more and more evidence that the Earth is really round and not flat, experience and history shows that you'll get nowhere. Why will you get nowhere? Because the flat Earth people will dig in their heels. They don't want to be displaced. And the more evidence you have, the more of a pariah you are. Wow. And a typical response is, well, you know, Ted Marr, he's a crackpot. Don't believe anything he says. And it's kind of difficult to pop up and say, no, I'm not a crackpot. You know, it just doesn't work. And once you get that reputation, you won't get any money, and people won't listen to what you have to say. And if the New York Times is interested in the latest findings, the science section on the flatness of the Earth and the few bumps that occur here and there, they're not going to go to Ted Marr, no matter what evidence he has. They'll go to the recognized and acknowledged experts in the field, and those are the flat Earth people. See, so you won't get anywhere. Yeah. And this is a real obstacle, and I've seen this happen with people in various fields, that despite really cogent arguments and sensible points of view, they can't get anywhere.
Wow.
And so we're going to combat this, and we have a way that I think is going to be effective, and that is simple. If we find the money from donors to fund Ted Marr in his experimental scientific approach to the round shape of the Earth, we're going to look for up to a dozen other independent scientists, independent of you, who also have a kind of similar idea that the Earth might be round, and we're going to fund them too. And so then what happens is at the annual meeting or annual conference on the shape of the Earth, where people, scientists interested in that topic come each year, suddenly you're going to find a dozen laboratories that report the same thing, that, hey, you know, you guys think the Earth is flat, but we have evidence, and the evidence from each of the dozen or so laboratories could be a different type of evidence using different instruments, different observations, but they all come to the conclusion, if that's the correct conclusion,
sure,
that the Earth is round, and that can't be ignored. They can say, well, Ted Marr, you know, he's a crackpot, don't pay any attention to him. But it won't work, because now there are a dozen laboratories, and by the way, they're well-funded. And so we think that if you got the goods, like the roundness of the Earth, which, by the way, is being challenged now by certain people. That's mm-hmm. a side note. But mm-hmm. but if you've got the goods, then people, especially young people, will pay attention.
Sure.
And it won't be long before there's a change of paradigm, and that basically, if it's an important subject, it amounts to a scientific revolution.
Wow, amazing, amazing.
Yeah, and we have a few proposals that we've accepted that really do look as though they're on the edge of such a scientific revolution.
Wow.
So we're really excited about that. And you know, if anybody in your listening group is interested in making a major donation, we can discuss the details of these particular projects, and you know, and acquaint them with the information, and maybe share the excitement that we feel. So these have the capacity to shake the Earth in really major ways, in ways that we've not seen for many, many years.
Wow, amazing, amazing. I have to ask you, Jerry, there's two more issues I'd like to bring up. A chairlifting paradox of anti-gravity in the House of Lords, Royal Society
of
Medicine.
Okay, so, House of Lords. So let me start with that one. So background, it has to do with homeopathy mostly.
Okay.
And some people don't know what homeopathy is. And mm-hmm. it started 200 years ago with a German physician named Hahnemann. Mm-hmm. And Hahnemann devised a variant on actually ancient ideas about taking some substance and diluting it multiple times. So you take a substance, you dilute it in water or in alcohol, and then you shake it violently. You kind of pound it down on the table. It's called succussion. And then you do it again. You take a small portion of that and add a lot of water and do the same. Shake it. And you keep doing that. And, of course, if you dilute it enough, in theory, all you have left is water.
Right.
So... you know, big yawn, it's water, it can't possibly do anything. And that's the sense of some people. On the other hand, if you look at the evidence, something different happens if you go through the procedure I just mentioned. And we have evidence on that, and so does a Russian group in the laboratory of professor or academician Konovalov, who is a highly distinguished Russian scientist who unfortunately couldn't attend the meeting I'm about to speak to, but sent a surrogate to present it. So in England, there's a move, and some people are suggesting that the move is by the pharmaceutical industry mm-hmm. to suppress homeopathy. Mm. The homeopathy has been used, and with some success, apparently, over many years to treat various illnesses. It's cheap, and some people advocate this instead of pharmaceuticals, so it's a bit of a threat to the pharmaceutical companies. Anyway, there's a move to make it illegal. Making it illegal.
Really? My goodness.
Illegal, right.
Wow.
Making it illegal means that
wow.
the practicing homeopaths in England would be out of business, and the people... Mm. Would have no choice. They could not. It would be illegal to take a homeopathic preparation, even though in places like India, for example, someone gave a statistic. I think there was something like 300 or 600,000 homeopaths throughout India. So you get sick, you go to the homeopath, they give you a remedy, you take it, and you feel better. So the argument by the opposition who want to suppress it is that it can't do anything because it's only water, and therefore, basically, the only possible effect could be a placebo effect. And if it's a placebo effect, then the person who's ill, you may be preventing them or from getting ordinary medical help, which in theory should be superior. That's the argument. So a conference was gathered together to in defense of that. And it was meant to be a basic science conference. And so I was delighted to be invited. There were actually four major speakers. This Russian guy I mentioned, myself, because the issue of memory of water is very important for what happens when you do these serial dilutions. And also two Nobel laureates, Luc Montagnier, whose name I mentioned a few minutes ago, and Brian Josephson, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics some years ago. And both of them presented as well. And so it was really a cool event because it was a seminar that took place in the Royal Society of Medicine. But the evening before was really special because there was a formal dinner for speakers and a few special attendees, a few meaning 100 or 150. And it took place at the House of Lords. So House of Lords is kind of a distinguished place, you know, and it was a formal black tie dinner, and everybody was properly dressed, except I must admit the two Nobel laureates were rather casual in their appearance, and as were their spouses. But anyway, it was a delightful evening that started with a tour of the parliament and then drinks on the veranda overlooking the Thames River, and then a formal dinner in a special room that's organized for that. So it was a really unusual and memorable day, followed by this seminar. And the seminar, the people at the seminar, presenters, provided what I think was clear evidence that there's a physical chemical basis that underlies the efficacy of homeopathic preparations. And one point that somebody brought up is about the placebo effect is, you know, it's possible that there's a placebo effect, but there are people who practice veterinary homeopathy, and it works on horses and dogs and whatever because these people have been in business, the veterinary homeopaths, for many years, and the horses keep coming back whenever they've got a problem.
Amazing.
This is one sad thing that happened about 2 weeks or 1 week afterward. One of the more prominent attendees who chaired one of the sessions was Peter Fisher, who is the personal physician to the Queen, because the royal family uses homeopathy as one of their main medical approaches. And I heard just a week after that unfortunately Peter Fisher was hit by a truck and died. It was so sad. Such a wonderful guy. A guy of some brilliance and of humanity as well, who chaired one of the sessions. It's amazing. You know somebody, and then boom, they're gone.
So sad.
Yeah.
Jerry, I have to tell you, you know, when you're having so much fun, time flies by so fast. We've got about a minute left, but
oh my goodness,
is it okay if I hold you over for a few minutes past the top of the hour? You can say hi to my guests. Martha Childress is here. Michiko from Tokyo will be coming on, and Leon McNaughton from the Clean Water Foundation. If you'd like, just a few minutes past the top, if that's okay.
You mean to say a few some more, or
a little bit more?
Listen,
you could. Sorry. Yeah, just to say a little bit more. I've actually got some emails in from listeners that they.
Okay, if I can just have maybe 5 minutes to tell you about the chair.
Of course. Yes, so, of course.
So the chair lifting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Something something that caught my attention because
we have to take a break in about 20 seconds, my friend. But please hold on.
Okay,
Jerry, have a cup of coffee, a cup of tea, and we'll come back to you in about 5 minutes. We'll just make some announcements.
Okay.
Thank you so much. This is Out of This World Radio with your host, Ted Marr, with the wonderful Jerry Pollack coming to us live today from the University of Washington. Please hold on, friends, for another exciting hour.